Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy, The Many Faces of Anonymous, by Gabriella Coleman. Narrated by Tavia Gilbert. Introduction. And now, you have got our attention. On July 29th, 2007, an entity calling itself Anonymous, unknown at the time to all except the most erudite internet denizens, uploaded a video to YouTube. A metallic digital tone thrums as a headless suited man appears over a blank background. A male voice begins to speak through the interference. "Dear Fox News," it intones. The news organization had recently devoted a segment entirely to a group they described as the Internet Hate Machine, a title the collective would subsequently adopt as a badge of honor. But for a collective that revels in trickery and guile, to simply laugh and dismiss such an exposé would be to miss a great opportunity. And so, the disturbingly ponderous, down-pitched voice of Anonymous continues. "The name and nature of Anonymous has been ravaged, as if it were a whore in a back alley, and then placed on display for the public eye to behold. Allow me to say quite simply, you completely missed the point of who and what we are. We are everyone, and we are no one. We are the face of chaos and the harbingers of judgment. We laugh at the face of tragedy. We mock those in pain. We ruin the lives of others simply because we can. A man takes out his aggression on a cat, we laugh. Hundreds die in a plane crash, we laugh. We are the embodiment of humanity with no remorse, no caring, no love, and no sense of morality." The video ends, "You have now got our attention." They certainly got mine. Soon after the video's publication, I became entangled in a multi-year research project on the collective that I have only now just twisted my way out of. This book monumentalizes that struggle. The video was meant to satirize Fox News' hyperbolic characterization of Anonymous as the ultimate purveyors of internet pranking and trolling, hackers on steroids, as Fox had called them. And yet, the creepy sentiments and chilling style captured the troll's terrifying side perfectly. Instead of overturning Fox News's ridiculously one-dimensional portrayal, the video seemingly confirmed it to the utmost, though only, of course, to those not in on the joke. This double meaning captures the dark humor of Anonymous, the lulls, as they call it, in a nutshell. The lulls, a deviant style of humor and a quasi-mystical state of being, has, as we will see, evolved with Anonymous from the beginning. And there was a time when spreading lulzy mayhem was all Anonymous seemed interested in. But not long after this parodic and bombastic video, Anons could be found at the heart of hundreds of political ops, becoming integral, even, to some of the most compelling political struggles of our age. In solidarity with Tunisian protesters, Anonymous hacked the Tunisian government's websites in January 2011. Months later, Spain's Indignados beamed the collective's signature Guy Fawkes mask onto a building in the Puerta del Sol, and Anons disseminated some of the first calls to occupy Wall Street. By then, the collective had established itself as a social, political force with a series of ops that remain some of its most memorable. In 2008, adherents to a new vision for Anonymous took Scientology to task after the litigious organization attempted to censor a famous video of Tom Cruise. Germinated for the sake of the lulls, Anons both realized their power to impact global struggles and the pleasure such engagements could provide. Anonymous became even more widely known 2 years later, in December 2010, the result of Operation Avenge Assange. Initiated by Anon Ops, one of the collective's more militant and prolific nodes, Anons engaged in digital direct action by launching a distributed denial of service, DDoS, campaign. This tactic, which disrupts access to web pages by flooding them with tidal waves of requests, was directed against financial institutions that had refused to process donations to WikiLeaks, including PayPal and MasterCard. With each operation, Anonymous was further emboldened. And yet, even after Anonymous drifted away from ungovernable trolling pandemonium to engage in the global political sphere, whenever people scrutinized its activist interventions, whether in a street protest or a high-profile computer intrusion, a question always seemed to loom. Are Anonymous and its adherents principled dissidents? Or are they simply kids screwing around on the internet as lol's drunk trolls? This confusion is eminently understandable. Beyond a foundational commitment to the maintenance of anonymity and a broad dedication to the free flow of information, Anonymous has no consistent philosophy or political program. While increasingly recognized for its digital dissent and direct action, Anonymous has never displayed a predictable trajectory. Given that Anonymous's ancestry lies in the sometimes humorous, frequently offensive, and at times deeply invasive world of internet trolling, the core logic of which seems, at least at first glance, to be inhospitable to the cultivation of activist sensibilities and politicized endeavors, it is remarkable that the name Anonymous became a banner seized by political activists in the first place. From trolling to the misfits of activism. Today, the broad deployment of both Anonymous's Guy Fawkes mask and the ideas it came to stand for among demonstrators occupying Tahrir Square and Polish politicians sitting in parliamentary chambers seem absurd when we consider the collective's origins. Before 2008, the moniker Anonymous was used almost exclusively for what one Anon describes as internet motherfuckery. Anonymous, birthed in the pits of 4chan's random bulletin board, B, often regarded as the asshole of the internet, was a name synonymous with trolling, an activity that seeks to ruin the reputations of individuals and organizations and reveal embarrassing and personal information. Trolls try to upset people by spreading grisly or disturbing content, igniting arguments, or engendering general bedlam. The chaos of feuding and flaming can be catalyzed by inhabiting identities, beliefs, and values solely for their mischievous potential, by invading online forums with spam, or by ordering hundreds of pizzas, taxis, and even SWAT teams to a target's residence. Whatever the technique, trolls like to say they do what they do for the lulz, a spirited but often malevolent brand of humor etymologically derived from LOL. One early Anonymous trolling raid, legendary to this day, set its sights on a virtual platform called Habbo Hotel, whose tagline enthusiastically beckons, "Make friends, join the fun, get noticed." A Finnish environment geared toward teenagers, it encourages visitors to create cutesy Lego-style avatars who can socialize together in the hotel and customize guest rooms with Fernie. On July 6, 2006, Anonymous logged onto the site in droves, presenting themselves, all, as black men in gray suits with prominent afros. By navigating just so, they were able to collectively assemble into human swastikas and picket lines, both of which prevented regular Habbo members, children mostly, from entering the hotel's pool. Anyone attempting to understand the reasons for these actions was informed by the mustachioed characters that the pool was closed due to fail and AIDS. A couple of years after the first Habbo raids, and a mere 6 months after they had been labeled the Internet Hate Machine, certain Anons began using the name and some associated iconography, headless men in black suits in particular, to coordinate political protests. This surprising metamorphosis sprouted from what many consider to be one of Anonymous's most legendary trolling provocations, targeting the Church of Scientology. In a previously unseen way, noted one participant in the raids, the greater Anon community united to unleash a hearty load of fuck you upon Scientology's entire cult empire. Impelled by the lulls, by the desire to release an avalanche of hilarious and terrifying mischief, thousands boarded the troll train, christened Project Chanology, to launch DDoS attacks on Scientology websites, order unpaid pizzas and escorts to Scientology churches across North America, fax images of nude body parts to churches, and propel a barrage of phone pranks, most notably against the Dianetics hotlines designed to offer advice regarding the first truly workable technology of the mind. Like most previous raids, many expected this hearty fuck you would run its course and then peter out after a few days of brutal and playful shenanigans. But a short video made by a small group of participants, concocted for the lulls alone, ignited a serious debate within the rank and file of Anonymous. The video declared war on the church. "For the good of your followers, for the good of mankind, and for our own enjoyment, we shall proceed to expel you from the internet and systematically dismantle the Church of Scientology in its present form." This ironic declaration of war spurred individuals into debate and then catapulted them onto the streets. On February 10, 2008, over 7,000 people in 127 cities protested the Church of Scientology's human rights abuses and acts of censorship. Anonymous thus shifted from, as one participating anon later explained to my class, ultra-coordinated motherfuckery, to the dissemination of incriminating facts about Scientology. They also forged bonds with an older generation of dissidents already at work highlighting the church's abuses. Trolling had given way to an earnest activist endeavor, as if Anonymous had emerged from its online sanctuary and set out to improve the world. Over the next 2 years, some Anonymous members would hatch unrelated activist subgroups, and many participants came to identify themselves as bona fide activists, albeit with a transgressive twist. Many of Anonymous's actions, like creating the publicity videos that have become a vernacular institution unto themselves, are entirely legal. But a subset of tactics, notably DDoS attacks and hacks, are illegal. Criminal offenses under all circumstances, at least in the United States. Government officials have thus made various attempts to slot a class of its activities under the umbrella term of cyber warfare and prosecute its participants accordingly. The epitome of this maneuver occurred on February 21, 2012, when the Wall Street Journal reported that General Keith Alexander, then director of the United States National Security Agency, NSA, had briefed officials at the White House in secret meetings. He claimed Anonymous could have the ability, within the next year or two, to bring about a limited power outage through a cyber attack. As the Wall Street Journal article ricocheted across social media platforms, questions were raised. Did this claim strike anyone as believable? Just what exactly constituted the ability to bring about a power outage? What would be an appropriate response if this were true? It is unlikely that we will ever find out whether the NSA's assessment was based on credible intelligence or whether it was meant simply to smear and discredit Anonymous. Either way, General Alexander's claim succeeded, at least momentarily, in portraying Anonymous as a menace akin to Islamic jihadists and the communist threat of yesteryear. Ultimately, it proved unconvincing. Anonymous, for all its varied tactics, both legal and illegal, online and offline, has never been known to publicly call for such an attack. And there is no evidence to suggest that it would so much as entertain the idea. Endangering human lives has never been a topic of discussion among members, even during the most helter-skelter of chat room and message board conversations. Subsequent news reports quoted activists and security experts who dismissed the NSA's claims as fear-mongering. Even though a tactic like this would be entirely out of character for Anonymous, the group's relationship with a court of public opinion remains ambivalent. Anonymous's methods are at times subversive, often rancorous, usually unpredictable, and frequently disdainful of etiquette or the law. Take doxing. The leaking of private information, such as social security numbers, home addresses, or personal photos, resides in a legal gray zone because some of the information released can be found on publicly accessible websites. A single Anonymous operation might integrate all three modes: legal, illegal, and legally gray tactics. And if there is an opportunity to infuse an operation with the lulls as well, someone will. A prime example is Operation BART from August 2011. Anonymous was spurred into action when San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART officials, sought to disable mobile phone reception on station platforms to thwart a planned anti-police brutality march. Local activists had called for the demonstration to protest the fatal shooting of Charles Hill, an unarmed passenger. Incensed by transportation authorities meddling in democratic expression, Anonymous helped organize a series of street demonstrations soon after. A couple of individuals hacked into BART's computers and released customer data in order to garner media attention. Someone also found a racy, semi-nude photo of BART's official spokesperson, Lyndon Johnson, on his personal website. The photo was republished on the BART Lulz website, along with this brazen rationalization. If you are going to be a dick to the public, then I'm sure you won't mind showing your dick to the public. Sometimes coy and playful, sometimes serious and inspiring, often all at once, as Op BART demonstrated so well, even to this day, these activist tricksters are still animated by a collective will toward mischief, toward the lulz. I did it for the lulz. Does Anonymous's ongoing embrace of lulzy mischief mean that researching them was a merry and lighthearted affair, the essence of an anthropological joyride? Looking for insights into Anonymous's surprising metamorphosis from trolling misfits to the misfits of activism, I began an anthropological study of the group in 2008. At first, my research was low-key, straightforward, and lighthearted. I attended protests and followed discussions on web forums and on Internet Relay Chat, IRC, one of the most important communication applications for Anonymous, and many other geeks and hackers. In 2011, as Anonymous grew more tentacles and activists initiated dozens of political operations, this side project became my life. For over 2 years, I was constantly jacked in, online for a minimum of 5 hours a day, struggling to keep abreast of all the simultaneous operations, some of them hidden from my view due to their clandestine nature. Researching Anonymous felt like following a thread through a dark and twisty path strewn with rumors, lies, secrets, and the ghoulish reality of spies and informants. The journey has been marked by soaring thrills, disappointing dead ends, and moral pretzels, wherein seemingly intractable ethical conundrums coexist easily with clear-cut examples of inspirational risk and sacrifice. Beyond the consequences of its actions, Anonymous's organizational structure itself felt similarly convoluted and bewildering. Over time, it became clear. Anonymous was not simply a maze, with a structure and escape route revealed in a view from above. Anonymous was a far more complicated and tangled warren. This was no static labyrinth, like the one built by Daedalus to house the Minotaur. It was an infinite machine operating a tight recursive loop, wherein mazes generated maze-generating mazes. In spite of the difficulties I faced when traversing this maze, I gradually became acquainted with Anonymous, and it with me, sometimes on a personal level. As an anthropologist does, I watched, listened, interviewed, debated, questioned, and prodded. At times I even participated, so long as my involvement was legal. My tasks were many: editing manifestos, teaching reporters how to find Anonymous, and correcting misinformation. My level of engagement was limited by self-imposed and external barriers. The anthropological imperative requires a certain degree of distance, while at the same time compelling one to delve deep. The trick is to integrate and go beyond simply relying on participants' explanations of events. I was sympathetic to many of Anonymous's tactics and causes, but not all of them. Moral quandaries of various sorts created critical distance. Due to the illegal nature of some activities, certain areas were off limits. This was better for Anonymous and for me. Later, after arrests and convictions, I was able to learn retrospectively about hidden acts. With the ascendancy of militant tactics among a new group of Anons, the stakes had changed by the summer of 2011. Anonymous began targeting Fortune 500 corporations and military defense contractors. Mercenary hackers doxed Anons, revealing their identities to law enforcement by publishing their legal names, personal photos, and addresses. Anons started to leak sensitive, classified, or humiliating information. At this juncture, the FBI got involved. And no matter how much Anonymous injected lulls into an op, humor could not stop the spread of a gut-wrenching unease among participants and observers of the group. So even if researching Anonymous was often a thrill, and certainly always an adventure, it ultimately made me paranoid. This was a deep paranoia that hovered over everything like a barometric disturbance before a tornado. It felt justified, but that might be just the paranoia talking. While researching Anonymous, it was imperative that I keep law enforcement away from me and from my data. Crossing a border meant days of preparation to secure my notes and put together a safe travel computer. Questioning by authorities always felt imminent. It wasn't a question of if the G-Men would visit, but when. Vigilance was necessary to protect my sources. I reminded Anonymous participants that they needed to be careful what they told me. I never sat in on their private channels as they were planning illegal operations. As for the government, I was hiding in plain sight. By no means was I Anonymous. That was the irony. I gave talks about Anonymous. I was interviewed by over 150 reporters, and I routinely discussed Anonymous on radio and television. As a scholar teaching at a prominent university, I was easy to find. On occasion, high-level corporate executives from some of the world's most powerful companies even reached out, calling me personally in the hope that I could offer some nugget of insight about an entity many of them had grown to fear. A recurring nightmare haunted me for years. Intelligence agents hammered on my door. I would jolt upright in bed, my heart pounding, "They're here." It was just like Poltergeist, except the bed wasn't shaking, and the demonic possession left as soon as I sat up. One day in 2012, I washed away the remaining threads of my turbulent slumber with a strong cup of coffee, putting the nightmare in the background for another day. With my brain fully booted, I realized that today, April 19th, the roles would be reversed. Today, I would be knocking on the doors of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, the Canadian equivalent of the CIA. With a mixture of trepidation, ambivalence, and especially curiosity, I had accepted CSIS's invitation to give a lecture about Anonymous. I went to discover what CSIS thought about Anonymous. Did they view them as a terrorist threat, a band of rambunctious/rabid activists, or something else entirely? My secret agenda was to test their reaction to the lulls. Could an agency that manages matters of national security bring itself to see the humor in Anonymous? To find out, I concocted a simple lulls litmus test. CSIS is headquartered in the outskirts of Canada's capital, Ottawa, in a large anodyne cream-colored building with teal accents. I arrived alone by taxi, awash in thoughts of Orwell, Brazil, Huxley, Kafka, and Bush/Obama's total surveillance. I asked myself, what am I doing here? What lies in the shadows behind the walls of Canada's spy agency? Could it be as bad as I am imagining? Do they have high-tech surveillance rooms like in Minority Report? Do they conduct psychological experiments in sterile, steel-lined interrogation rooms? Adjusting my ill-fitting business suit, I forced myself to think that inside were boring office cubicles, with people pushing paper and scheduling meetings destined for drab conference rooms with speakerphones in the middle of their tables. Maybe there was a passive-aggressive note taped to the refrigerator in the break room because someone ate all of the Tim Hortons sugary Timbits that were for the going-away party later that day. A water-stained note over the sink with the words, "Your mother doesn't work here. You will have to clean up after yourself." It will be fine, I told myself. To minimize my angst, I had promised myself I would offer nothing new or secret, sticking to what was already public and donating my modest honorarium to a civil liberties organization. But despite having given the same lecture dozens of times, I walked through the front door feeling more diminutive than my 5-foot self. A woman with a suit greeted me. Everything felt unremarkable. There was nothing ominous in sight, just bland office plants. I was brought to a room with a small stage. The atmosphere was tense. I couldn't discern the expression on anyone's face. I was nearly paralyzed with dread. Then I worried that my nervousness was going to make me say something I shouldn't. These agents, after all, were exceedingly well-trained in the art of information extraction. They would take advantage of any weakness or opportunity to gain an advantage. With over 40 people staring at me, the atmosphere of seriousness felt like it was burning right through my suit. Nevertheless, I'd done this so many times that I was on autopilot, and it wasn't until 10 minutes into my talk that I noticed my hands shaking slightly as I attempted to click the play button on my computer in order to fire up my LULZ litmus test, the famous viral video made by Anonymous that had ignited their revolutionary spirit. Every time I had shown this clip in the past, three sentences in particular had without fail provoked laughter. Would CSIS employees LOL at the LULZ? In the video, as clouds move quickly over a large, indistinct glass corporate building, a dramatic voice intones, "Anonymous has therefore decided that your organization should be destroyed. For the good of your followers, for the good of mankind, and for our own enjoyment, we shall proceed to expel you from the internet and systematically dismantle the Church of Scientology in its present form." The room erupted in laughter. Mission accomplished. There was no better proof of the infectious spirit of the LULZ than this moment. Intelligence agents were laughing at the LULZ-y video made by anonymous trolls that gave birth to the threat they were tasked with assessing. "I will get out of here alive after all," I silently sighed. After my lecture, a smaller group of us relocated to a cramped and dingy conference room with no windows to eat bland sandwiches and cookies under the glare of fluorescent lights. I secretly wondered if there was a nicer conference room with skylights reserved for the political scientists or economists and other more highly esteemed guests. We sat down in the office chairs and went around the room introducing ourselves. I was still too out of sorts to remember particular roles or titles, much less names. I was certainly not taking notes or secretly recording the conversation. I suspect they were. For all I knew, I could be talking to janitors or to employees with the highest level of security clearance. One title did stick out, though, that of the other anthropologist in the room. When introduced, he nodded and smiled at me. I, meanwhile, tried hard to keep my poker face intact. All sorts of questions sprung to mind. Is he actually trained as an anthropologist? Where did he go to school? Who was his PhD advisor? When and why did he decide to work for the CSIS? Do they pay better than academia? But I kept my queries to myself. I was worried he would misconstrue my curiosity as interest in working for CSIS, and I wanted to avoid any recruitment overtures. During the course of what at first felt like a meandering conversation, it eventually became apparent why I had been invited. They wanted to know one thing: whether I thought Anonymous had set their sights on taking down the power grid. The timing was not accidental. Just a month earlier, the NSA had stated that Anonymous was an imminent threat to national security, and I suppose Canada was feeling a bit of international pressure to monitor the shadowy group. I answered honestly. "For all its legal and illegal tactics to date," I explained, "Anonymous had never publicly called for such an attack. There was no evidence at the time to suggest that the group would so much as consider doing such a thing." I did not feel like I was divulging anything secret, as I had commented to the press about this very subject. In fact, I felt like I was doing Anonymous a favor. Of course, as a busy professor, I could not spend all of my time on the many channels of the various IRC networks, much less monitor every single chat room where such a conversation could take place. There were also private conversations and invite-only channels I never actually entered. "Their sociology is labyrinthine," I explained with deliberation, likely exhibiting my own frustrations with navigating and researching Anonymous. I had probably spent more hours staring at my computer and chatting with anonymous participants than any non-anon, with the possible exception of informants, who were forced to be online nearly full-time. I explained that I had never even seen a hint of such a plan. Indeed, every radical action, even the doxing of belligerent police officers, provoked contentious debate about its moral appropriateness. While Anonymous is often duplicitous and devilishly confusing, I explained, Anons are certainly not seeking to kill anyone. They organize at home, possibly in their underwear, typing away madly at the computer. The only violence some participants engage in is likely of the virtual type, during their World of Warcraft video game battles that some percentage of them surely must play. To hammer my point home, I offered a bit of humor, paraphrasing one Anon who had cracked the following joke soon after the NSA claimed that Anonymous was indeed capable of targeting the grid. "That's right, we're definitely taking down the power grid. We'll know we've succeeded when all the equipment we use to mount our campaign is rendered completely useless." Postures loosened. Laughter again reverberated among the G-men, and women. This was 2012, after all. And as far as I could tell, everyone seemed genuinely relieved by my assessment. They could go back to focusing on more pressing matters. The joke opened the door to further conversation concerning the media's central role in amplifying the power of Anonymous. One CSIS agent shared his anger at the media for making this collective of collectives more powerful than they ought to have been. I was, I have to admit, relishing the fact that the G-men and Anons, mutually opposed at one level, were nevertheless, very loosely, allied in holding an ambivalent attitude toward the mass media. We all agreed that the media had helped to make Anonymous what it was today. Then the resident CSIS anthropologist, whose specialty was Middle East terrorism, made an offhand comment that shocked even me. Jihadists, he explained, were impressed by the level of media attention Anonymous attained. Did I hear that correctly? I wondered. I just could not fathom Al-Qaeda operatives watching Anonymous videos, much less grasping the nature of their culture or politics, and especially not the lulls. I imagined that jihadists would be rather repelled by Anonymous's secular, infidel, offensive practices. Laughing heartily together, we all agreed that those jihadist terrorists likely did not celebrate the lulls, or were utterly devoid of them. The conversation reminded me of something one Anon had told me during an informal online chat. A. Yeah, it's that idea of humor and irreverence which is at the heart of this. Anonymous. It's what will stop it ever being able to be labeled terrorist. Despite the laughter, I still felt rather uncomfortable and hyper-aware of my mask of scholarly detachment. Appearing cool and composed on the outside, on the inside I was thinking to myself, I can't believe I am joking about jihadists, Anonymous, and the lulls with CSIS. I wanted nothing more than to leave, which I finally did at the conclusion of lunch. I was relieved to return to my hotel. I tried to push away the creeping thought that my room at the Lord Elgin Hotel in downtown Ottawa, booked by CSIS, was bugged. Even today, I am not sure how I feel about my decision to visit CSIS. In those situations, one can divulge, quite unwillingly, important information, even when officials are not expressly seeking or asking for anything particular. Maybe there is something unethical, too, about disclosing how important the media is in amplifying Anonymous's power, a bit like drawing open a curtain to reveal that the wizard is a little old man pulling at the levers of a machine. On the other hand, the media's power is an open secret within Anonymous, a topic routinely discussed by the activists themselves. In hindsight, and for better or worse, I believe some element of the trickster spirit nudged me to accept CSIS's invitation. Tricksters, like the Norse god Loki, have poor impulse control. They are driven by lust or curiosity. Intrigue propelled me to visit CSIS, despite my anxiety and reservations. I had a burning question that I needed answered. Would they laugh at the lulls? So I guess, like trolls. I did it for the lols. Thanks to my glimpse inside Canada's spy agency, I got my answer. The lols can be, nearly, universally appreciated. But I learned even more than that, thanks to the other anthropologist in the room. That final joke about the jihadists and the lols taught me another lesson about Anonymous, which is important to convey as we start this adventure. No single group or individual can claim legal ownership of the name Anonymous, much less its icons and imagery. Naturally, this has helped Anonymous spread across the globe. It has now become the quintessential anti-brand brand, assuming various configurations and meanings, even as it has also become the popular face of unrest around the globe. Even if the name Anonymous is free to take, as Topiary, an Anonymous activist, put it before he was arrested, "You cannot arrest an idea," the jihadist example is a powerful reminder that its radical openness does not mean everyone can or even wants to embrace the name or its attendant imagery. Culture has a funny way of asserting itself, even among a group of activists who seek to defy boundaries and who have erected one of the most accessible, resilient, and open domains of activism today. Indeed, by the time I visited CSIS in 2012, Anonymous had become multitudinous, prolific, and unpredictable. Of course, since the collective is a byproduct of the internet, it is unsurprising that Anonymous rises up most forcefully and shores up most support when defending values associated with this global communication platform, like free speech. As one participant once put it, free speech is non-negotiable. But what they have demonstrated time and again is they are not restricted to a concern with civil liberties. Over the last 5 years, activists have contributed to an astonishing array of causes, from publicizing rape cases, as they did in Halifax, Canada, and Steubenville, Ohio, to assisting in the Arab and African Spring of 2011. Various factors conspire to secure the group's flexibility. There are no agreed-upon mandates to uphold. Participants associated with Anonymous steadfastly resist institutionalization. Its reputation is difficult to sully. You don't even need to be a hacker. No, really, to participate in Anonymous operations. The group's bold Hollywood-style aesthetics strike a familiar chord in the society of the spectacle. And when Anonymous reacts to world events, it engages in a broad range of activities, with leaking and exposing security vulnerabilities acting as two of its signal interventions. All these elements, which also come together in different proportions and configurations, make it almost impossible to know when or why Anonymous will strike, when a new node will appear, whether a campaign will be successful, and how the group might change direction or tactics during the course of an operation. Its unpredictability may be what makes Anonymous so frightening to governments and corporations across the world. Although devilishly hard to study, Anonymous is neither wholly random nor simply chaotic. To be anonymous means to follow a series of related principles. Anonymous follows a spirit of humorous deviance, works through diverse technical bodies, such as IRC, is built on an anti-celebrity ethic, and intervenes politically in astoundingly rich and varied ways. This book will seek to unravel some of the complexities and paradoxes inherent to a politically engaged Anonymous. But before we turn to its activist interventions, let's take a close look at the grisly underworld of trolling from which Anonymous hatched. Chapter 1. On Trolls, Tricksters, and the Lols. Prior to 2008, when Anonymous unexpectedly sprouted an activist sensibility, the brand had been used exclusively for what, in internet parlance, is known as trolling, the targeting of people and organizations, the desecration of reputations, and the spreading of humiliating information. Despite the fame Anonymous accrued in its mass trolling campaigns, it was certainly not the only player in the game. The trolling pantheon was then, and remains today, both large and diverse. Trolling is a multifarious activity that flourishes online and boasts a range of tightly knit associations. such as the Patriotic Negras, Bantown, Team Roomba, Russell League, a variety of genres, differentiated mostly by target. For example, griefers target gamers, RIP trolls target the families and friends of the recently deceased, and a small pantheon of famed individuals, Violentocres, Jamev. Its originary point extends far before the alpha of the internet, taking root in the vagaries of myth and oral culture. Despite this diversity, contemporary internet trolls are united in an almost universal claiming of lulls as the casual force and desired effect of their endeavors. Our story can begin with one of the most notorious pursuants. One day, completely out of the blue, I received a phone call from one of the most famous trolls of all time, Andrew Orenheimer, known to most simply as Weave. He reached out to me on August 28, 2010, in a 60-second phone message. "Yes, Ms. Coleman, this is Weave. That is W-E-E-V, and you might be familiar with my work. I see that you are giving a presentation on hackers, trolls, and the politics of spectacle, and I just want to say that I am the master of the spectacle. This is my art, ma'am. And also, you have given some sort of presentation on the lulls, and I was in the room when the lulls was first said, so I want to make sure that you're interpreting and representing my culture and my people correctly. I don't want some charlatan that is telling lies about my history and my culture. So I would like to talk with you some and understand what you are doing to make sure that you are not just another bullshit academic. So hit me up. My email is gluttony@xxx.com. That is gluttony@xxx.com. I expect a response, Ms. Coleman. It is extremely important. After listening, I was so startled I actually dropped the phone. I was overcome with excitement, but also fear. I picked the phone up, rapidly punched in a seemingly endless stream of numbers, listened to the message three more times, recorded it, and promptly went home, only to spend the rest of the evening brooding. I wished he had never called. Weave's reputation obviously preceded him. Despite my rudimentary research on trolls and my ongoing research on the activism of Anonymous, I had avoided him like the bubonic plague. Although trolling is often experienced and disguised as play, it is also shrouded in mystery, danger, and recklessness. Weave is a past president of one of the most exclusive trolling cliques still in existence today, the offensively named Gay Nigger Association of America, GNAA. Affiliates quiz prospective members on trivia about an obscure porn film called Gay Niggers from Outer Space, which inspired the group's name. Reaching out to such a revolting troll might spell trouble. Trolls are notorious for waging so-called ruin life campaigns, in which they spread humiliating stories, regardless of truthfulness, about a chosen target, and leak vital information like addresses and social security numbers. The effect is akin to being cursed, branded, and stigmatized all at once. The psychological effects can be terrifyingly long-lasting. But since I also ran a risk by ignoring his request, he did, after all, flag it as extremely important, I sent him an email a few days later. And since I had already taken the plunge, I also figured it might make sense to acquaint myself with another genre of trolling. In contrast to Weave's boastful, elitist, self-aggrandizing style, Anonymous had historically demonstrated a far more self-effacing and populist mode of trolling. Like two sides of a coin, both belonged to the same tribe, while also countering one another. For about 2 minutes, I even entertained, with faint excitement, the prospect of detailing a troll typology. Just as my anthropological ancestors once categorized tribes, skulls, and axes, perhaps I could do the same with trolls and their horrible exploits, trollishly playing, all the while, with my discipline's historical penchant for irrelevant and sometimes racist categorization. Quickly, the excitement faded as I contemplated the ruinous reality this could bring down upon me if I got on the wrong side of these notorious trolls. I remembered that I had already decided to focus on the activism of Anonymous and not its trolling heyday for a very good reason. In the end, I hoped Weave would ignore the email from me sitting in his inbox. But when he emailed me back, I realized there was nothing to do but commit. We finally connected via Skype chat. His handle was Dirk Diggler, after the porn star protagonist of the 1997 film Boogie Nights. Later, when we switched to IRC, he used Weave. Dirk Diggler. How are you? Biela. Good, and you? Dirk Diggler. Coming down off of some vile substance. Biela. You are up early. Dirk Diggler. Methylene dioxy pyrovalerone, I think it was called. It's late, technically, as I haven't slept. Biela. I woke up at 3 a.m., but that is not all that unusual for me. Dirk Diggler. I am working on my latest shitstorm right now. Disruptive technological developments are great. Biela. You are pretty adept at that as well. Dirk Diggler. Yes, I am switching from the MDPV to the coffee. I am hoping this will smooth the downward spiral long enough for me to ship this motherfucker live today. Biela. No chance you will be in New York City in the near future, is there? Dirk Diggler. Probably not. It's a vile city. Biela. Haha, really? Dirk Diggler. Disgusting place. Biela. How come? Dirk Diggler. The only decent people in New York City are the black Israelites. New York City is a city founded on the repulsive order of the financiers. His denunciation of the repulsive order of the financiers had the ring of truth, given the recent financial mess their recklessness had engendered. So I found myself, only minutes into my first bona fide conversation with a world-famous troll, in agreement with him. Biela. That is true. Dirk Diggler. It is a sinful and decadent place. Biela. There are less and less spaces for the non-rich. Dirk Diggler. And wherever immoral people are in control, I find that everyone tries to emulate them. Biela. Detroit is like the only city where there is possibility, in my humble opinion. Big city. Dirk Diggler. Nah, Slab City has the best potential in all of the USA. Part of God's war is going on right there, right now. Biela. Never been. It is true, I had not spent time in Slab City. It was, in fact, the first time I had even heard about it. And so, as we chatted, I was also Googling Slab City, which actually exists and is a fascinating Wild West campground slash squatter haven in Colorado. I soon came to learn that even if Weave often lies, he also often speaks the truth, and his knowledge of the strange, fantastical, and shocking is encyclopedic. He is a natural ethnographer of the most extreme and vile forms of human esoterica. By dedicating much of his teenage and early adult years to hacking and trolling, and the consumption of large quantities of drugs, if he is to be believed, Weave had amassed a vast catalog of technical and human exploits. His most famous coup, which won him a 3.5-year jail sentence, was directed at AT&T, a beloved target among hackers because of its cozy information-sharing practices with the U.S. government. AT&T's well-known activities in Room 641A, a telecommunication interception facility operated by the NSA, now seem quaint given the news that most major telecommunications providers and internet companies provide the U.S. government generous access to customer data. Weave targeted AT&T with GOATC Security, the name given to GNAA's impromptu security group. They discovered in June 2010 that the giant American telco had done something stupid and irresponsible. AT&T's iPad customer data was posted on the internet unprotected. Typically, a company with good security practices will encrypt things like customer names, email addresses, and the unique ID numbers associated with these iPads. But AT&T had not, at least in this instance, encrypted anything. While they didn't exactly leave the customer data sitting on a doorstep with a sign saying, "Come and get it," the data was still unusually easy to access. Indeed, GOATC Security figured out an easy way to slurp the data using a script, a short, easy-to-use computer program, which was written by GNAA/GOATC member Daniel Spittler, a.k.a. Jackson Brown. The Gray Hat security crew called it, with uncanny precision, the iPad 3G account slurper, and used it to harvest the data of 140,000 subscribers. The opportunity to expose shoddy security of this magnitude is irresistible to any hacker, even one like Weave, who, as he told me over dinner when we finally met in person, is not even that talented of a technologist. Or perhaps more likely, he is just too lazy to do the grunt work, since he certainly grasps many of the finer technical points pertaining to security. Whatever the case, Spittler wrote the script itself and has since pleaded guilty in court. And yet Weave was also convicted in November 2012 for hacking AT&T's system, a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, CFAA. But the fact remains, since there was no security to speak of, there was nothing, technically, to hack. Daniel Spittler's script did not compromise an otherwise secure system, and Weave, who contributed minor improvements to the script, mostly acted as the publicist. He offered the vulnerability to news outlets for free. He was interested in exposing AT&T's shocking lack of security in the public interest and boosting his public profile. The CFAA, it must be said, is a decidedly blunt legal instrument, so broad that it affords prosecutors tremendous power in any legal proceeding that relates, in virtually any way, to the vague notion of unauthorized computer access. The activities need not be hacking at all. Some courts have interpreted unauthorized access to mean computer use that simply violates the terms of service or other rules posed by the computer's owner. After his CFAA conviction, Weave's case attracted a trio of top-notch lawyers, Orrin Kerr, Marsha Hoffman, and Tor Eklund. They appealed his case, seeking to overturn what they, along with many security professionals, deemed a dangerous precedent, capable of chilling vital future security research. The security industry relies on hackers and researchers discovering vulnerabilities, using the same methods as criminal hackers in order to expose weakness and strengthen infrastructure for both private and public good. Finally, in April 2014, and only after he had served roughly 12 months of a 41-month sentence, his case was vacated, but not due to the CFAA portion of the appeal, instead due to the question of venue. The court determined that New Jersey, where the original case was tried, was not the state where the offense was committed. Tor Eklund explained the importance of this legal ruling to The Guardian. If the court had ruled the other way, you would have had universal venue in computer fraud and abuse cases, and that would have had huge implications for the internet and computer law. Still, although Weave's supporters were thrilled that he was now free and pleased that questions of venue had been clarified, many were disappointed that the proceedings left the broader CFAA issue untouched. The dangerous precedent remained. By taking this information to the media, Weave demonstrated an intent beyond mere trolling. Any self-respecting hacker will cry foul in the face of terrible security. Taking it to the press, which will generate a huge fuss about it, can be a responsible thing to do. Of course, to hear Weave tell the story, it was clear that he also did it for the lulz. He would giggle whenever goatsy security was mentioned in news reports about the incident. He imagined millions of people Googling the strange name of the security group and then recoiling in horror at the sight of a vile anal supernova beaming off their screen. Goatsy is a notoriously grotesque internet image of a man hunched over and pulling apart his butt cheeks wider than you might think is humanly possible. Those who view it are forever unable to unsee what they have just seen. Unable to forget even the smallest detail, their minds seared by the image as if the gaping maw, adorned with a ring, were a red-hot cattle brand. The immaturity of the joke would escalate Weave's giggles into tears, which spilled out the sides of his pinched eyes. He would hunch over, holding his stomach as his shoulders shook, his laugh like a demonic jackhammer. Clearly, Weave offended everyone, including law enforcement. The ultimate testament to his incendiary nature is, perhaps, the judge's rather stiff sentence. After all, he was not even party to writing the script. The night before his sentencing, he wrote on Reddit, a popular nerd website, that My regret is being nice enough to give AT&T a chance to patch before dropping the data set to Gawker. I won't nearly be as nice next time. To justify the sentence, the prosecution cited his Reddit comments not once, not twice, but three times. For Weave, such incendiary behavior is par for the course. He has recorded hateful speeches railing against Jews and African Americans. Sermons, as he calls them, which can be viewed on YouTube. They are so hateful that they even discussed other trolls. We started chatting soon after his legal troubles relating to AT&T began. During the next 5 months, we chatted often. There were some moments that can only be described as strange. Take, for instance, a conversation that occurred on December 12th, 2010. Weave: hello there, how are you?
Biela: pretty good, and you?
Weave: can't complain. GNAA has switched forms of governance. It is now an Athenian democracy, where those who have completed their military service, in other words, done any cool trolling, are now eligible to vote on measures. I was, I recall vividly, incredulous, but I still managed, barely, to type a response.
Biela: really?
Then, out of the blue, as is often the case with internet chatting, especially with Weave, he hopped to another topic while I was in the midst of responding to questions of governance. Weave: my bondsman called me randomly.
Biela: what was it before?
Before becoming an Athenian democracy. Weave: yes. I suspect I may be arrested tomorrow or on the 16th. I am having to divide up responsibilities, because nobody can do all the shit I did.
Biela: for real?
I mean, why do you think you are being arrested? Weave: my bondsman called me randomly to verify my current location. Last time that happened, the door got kicked in the next day.
At the time, he was under investigation. I know he was a troll and all, but let's face it, jail sucks. I told him I would visit and expressed my sympathies.
Weave: thank you. I will enjoy the company.
Biela: and gluten-free treats that I will bring.
Weave: big grin. I just discovered how to make a passable gluten-free bread. You gotta just use a variety of shit. Brown rice, tapioca, and taff flours. And potato starch.
It was natural, then, that Weave, a gluten-free troll chatting with a gluten-free anthropologist, would seamlessly transition into a discussion of Pilates. Regrettably, I never did get a proper answer on the subject of troll governance. Many conversations followed this unpredictable, always entertaining arc. I was earnest with him for the most part, but I played along with his self-styled hoaxer role. At the same time, I couldn't resist calling him out on his bullshit sometimes, even trolling him just a little.
Weave: I have a very broad range of knowledge for a high school dropout.
Biela: except you studied anthro at James Madison. Smile.
Weave: yes, well...
Biela: but you do have a broad range of knowledge.
Weave: I am just a poor country boy from Arkansas. I dropped out of college because it was too much for my simple southern mind. Plus, I was disgusted at the degeneracy of American institutions. All the social sciences have become an elaborate scheme for giving white kids racial inferiority complexes, or destroying the gender roles that make our society work.
As a social science professor, I had some insider knowledge of this elaborate scheme. I could not help but feed him some of my own lies.
Biela: oh my god, totally.
Weave:
or otherwise promoting Judeo-Bolshevist/Marxist ideologues.
Biela: they secretly train us to do that. It is quite intensive.
Weave: I don't know if you're being sarcastic or sincere, is the hilarious part.
Biela: LOL. Welcome to Biela's world of chatting with Weave as well. He did, in fact, serve jail time in various states, ending up in New Jersey, where he was released on bail February 28, 2011, to await trial. Since he was no longer allowed online, our chats came to an end. Instead, we continued to converse in person over gluten-free food in New York City. I footed the bill since he was really, really broke. Although he did teach me a fair bit about trolling, he never used his skills on me. Although Weave's bail conditions banned him from using a computer, he still managed to practice his craft. Weave, like many trolls, likes to dupe people in order to draw attention to himself. Putting oneself in the limelight feels great, especially if you don't need to pay a PR person to post a fake sex tape. In May 2011, as summer finally descended on New York City, he excitedly texted me. "Google my name," he wrote. I did as commanded, and hundreds of news articles